We are here to look at the letter. We call it a book, but it really is a letter that James wrote to people who were experiencing some tough times. And we've chosen for the whole letter of James the title for the whole book, Walk the Talk. In other words, put to action what you say. But I'm changing that a little bit this morning because in chapter 3, verses 1 through 12, which is what we're going to be reading here in a moment, I think probably for this particular section, a better title would be Talk the Walk. And so we're going to find out why I think that as we read it here. So James chapter 3, verses 1 through 12 says, Dear brothers and sisters, not many of you should become teachers in the church. For we who teach will be judged more strictly. Indeed, we all make many mistakes. For if we could control our tongues, we would be perfect and could also control ourselves in every other way. We can make a large horse go wherever we want by means of a small bit in its mouth. And a small rudder makes a huge ship turn wherever the pilot chooses to go, even though the winds are strong. In the same way, the tongue is a small thing that makes grand speeches. But a tiny spark can set a great forest on fire. And the tongue is a flame of fire. It is a whole world of wickedness corrupting your entire body. It can set your whole life on fire, for it is set on fire by hell itself. People can tame all kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and fish. But no one can tame the tongue. It is restless and evil, full of deadly poison. Sometimes it praises our Lord and Father. Sometimes it curses those who have been made in the image of God. And so blessing and cursing come pouring out of the same mouth. Surely, my brothers and sisters, this is not right. Does a spring of water bubble out both fresh water and bitter water? Does a fig tree produce olives or a grapevine produce figs? No. And you can't draw fresh water from a salty spring. We're going to get to this in just a minute. I want to get a snapshot, if you will, of the passage. A couple of weeks ago, we were driving along and I saw something that caught my eye, and I was partially because it was a bumper sticker, and we don't see too many bumper stickers anymore. You know, they kind of come and gone. In fact, you don't see too many bumpers anymore. It's hard to tell if a car has a bumper. They've learned to hide them. But bumper stickers came in the 60s. There were a lot of anti-war things and peace signs and all that kind of stuff. And then through the 70s, in the 80s, 90s, I'm not sure when they started trailing off, but it seems like there aren't that many bumper stickers around anymore. And I see that as a good thing. I don't believe I've ever put a bumper sticker on any of my cars. And then someplace back in my mind, I'm thinking maybe there was one, but I can't remember what it was. But I saw this bumper sticker as I was driving along, and it caught my eye. It said, you don't have to believe everything you think. And I just thought, wow, that's profound. What does it mean? And so I spent the next several days thinking about what this meant. I knew it was good. You know, there's something in there that told me, yeah, that's a good thought. But I started thinking about it, and I kind of decided that, at least for me, and you can get out of this whatever you want. I think that's the point. But for me, it's that often I have fears. You know, I think something is going to harm me, or I think something is going to harm somebody else, and I start acting like it's true. I start kind of internalizing it, and I start believing something that I merely had a thought about. And in my older age, and I didn't say old age, I said older age, I've realized that I find myself fearing more things. It's kind of weird. Things I never used to fear all of a sudden become fearful to me. You know, I used to do some pretty reckless type of things, and now, you know, you get me near an edge of a cliff or something, even with a big railing, you know, I don't want to look. I don't want to be close to it. I don't want to see other people jumping the fence at Yosemite and going out and sitting on the ledge and looking down 2,000 feet, you know? It just gives me physically gives me the creeps to see that. And I didn't used to fear that, but I start believing that something bad is going to happen. As long as I can remember, have had this fear. Anytime we get ready to take a vacation, a trip of any kind, my wife will tell you, about a week before we go, I start getting fearful. I start getting quiet. I start thinking about things that I need to pack, things I might use. Pretty soon I got the car full of all these safety items, you know, that we'll never need. But I start getting kind of uptight. 5 minutes down the road, I'm fine. But I have that fear. I start believing that, oh, man, we're going to get out there and we're going to be all by ourselves. We're not going to be in cell range and the tires are going to go out. And, you know, I start imagining all these things. I don't have to believe what I think, but I do so often. How about the self-worth? I've struggled with that my whole life. You know, you start thinking because of what other people say that you're not worth very much. And so you start thinking those things, and pretty soon it becomes a belief. You start believing what you just used to think was maybe a possibility, or doubting the worth of other people. So you don't have to believe everything you think. In fact, I'd say it's probably a good thing not to. But we do start overanalyzing the way people look at us, or words that they use, or tone of voice, or some body language. You start overanalyzing that stuff. And the more we think about it, and the more it becomes a part of our thought life, there's some point there where often it becomes a belief. And I went back and was looking at the beginning of the letter that James wrote. And here he's writing to these people who have been scattered because of persecution, because they believe in Jesus. They're being persecuted, and so they've left Jerusalem, they've left these places and tried to find some other places where they could operate, you know, their businesses and so forth. And they've begun to think some things, and it's starting to become a belief for them. And James addresses that. You know, they think that persecution is a terrible thing. And I'm not saying it's a good thing. But James says, don't believe it. Because, he says in verse 2, consider it all joy whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Nobody likes the testing part, but you kind of like the end result when you realize, oh, because of that testing, I now can persevere like I didn't used to be able to. So they think it's a bad thing, and James tells them, don't believe it. They thought that they were righteous people. And James says, don't believe it. If your life doesn't show it, don't believe it. Just because you think you're righteous doesn't make you righteous. If you're not living righteously. They thought that being poor meant that God didn't love them as much as God loved the rich. And that's why they were showing favoritism to the rich people, who, generally speaking, were the ones who were mistreating them. And James says, don't believe it. God chose the poor of this world to confound the wise and the rich. Don't believe it. They thought that intellectual belief was sufficient, that they could just believe the doctrine, they could believe the truth, and they'd be all right. And James says, don't believe it. Your life has to show it. And so chapter 1 is full of this, you think one thing, but don't believe it. You've got to do this. You've got to follow through. So I invented another bumper sticker. I still won't put it on my car, but I think there's a follow-up bumper sticker for you don't have to believe everything you think, and that is, you don't have to say everything you believe. You don't have to say everything you believe. Now, I posted that on Facebook, and immediately I got a response from somebody who says, well, why don't you tell us? It'd be really interesting to know. When should we say what we believe? When should we not say what I need some, they wanted to know, to have the checklist and when it's okay to say this and when it's not and when should we hold back. And, well, James isn't getting into that, and I'm not really going to get into that. But I will say that I back up my statement that we don't have to say everything you believe by looking at Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29 as an example. Ephesians 4:29 says, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. Notice the emphasis on the others. So you don't have to say everything you believe. You only say it if it's helpful for building others up according to their needs, not yours, and that it may benefit those who listen. So if James here in chapter 3 is saying, you don't have to say everything you believe, because if you can learn to control your tongues completely, you're going to be perfect. That's what you need to learn how to do. If you can do that, then you've come a long way. So you don't have to believe everything you say. Everything you think, and you don't have to say everything you believe. For instance, you may believe something, and you may believe correctly that something is true, but saying it at that particular time, in that particular place, to that particular person, may be inappropriate. Okay? So I may believe that the woman sitting at the table next to me is beautiful, but I don't have to say it. It would be inappropriate for me to just blurt that out. That would be crazy. Even though I'm believing something that is absolutely true, I don't have to say it. I may be correct in what I believe, but I may have the wrong motives. I may have a wrong motive, and in which case I should probably keep it to myself. Now, I've been looking at this this chapter, I think, for 2 months. When did we first come up with this? 2 months ago or something? So before I went on my big trip, I knew it. And so while I was gone, I was reading it over and over again. I wasn't really doing a lot of investigation, study, and that kind of thing. But I was reading it, thinking about it. So I've been into this chapter for 2 months, feeling pretty good. And just this week, I said something that I shouldn't have said. And the reason I shouldn't have said it was because my motive was bad. And here's my motive, and this is my personal problem. You have your own problems that you have to deal with, so you have to make this application yourself. But I love getting a laugh. If I can say something and get a laugh from somebody, it's pretty hard for me not to say it. Even though it may not be the right thing to say, even though it may be true, I shouldn't say it, because the motive is to embarrass the other person and bring some attention to myself, and everybody go, oh, that Tom, he's a pretty funny guy. Except at home, he's not so funny at home. That's what my wife tells people. She said, well, he's not that funny at home. Prophet is without honor in his own hometown. So is a comedian. So if you have the wrong motive, just because you believe it doesn't mean you ought to say it. You may believe the truth, but risk wasting it by saying it in a certain situation. Now, that one's, I could let you think about that for a minute, but we haven't got that much time. So I'm going to go back to Matthew chapter 6. If you want to follow me there, interesting passage, because Jesus is talking in Matthew chapter 7 about not judging others. Don't judge, or you will too will be judged. In the same way you judge others, you're going to be judged with the same measure. And he talks all about this not judging stuff. And then he gets to verse 6 and he says, do not give dogs what is sacred, and do not throw your pearls to pigs, If you do, they may trample them under your feet and turn it and tear you to pieces. This always kind of interested me because he's coming off of these, don't judge, don't judge, don't judge. And then he says, now you have to judge who the dogs are, who the pigs are. And if what you're saying is worthwhile, you know, you do have to do some judging. You have to use some common sense here. I've sworn to wipe that phrase from my mind because I don't believe common sense exists anymore, so I'm not going to use the term. But you just have to use some sense in what you're saying. And he says, don't give dogs what is sacred. Don't throw pearls to pigs because they're just going to be trampled. They're not going to be appreciated. What's he mean by that? Well, later on we see he sends out the 12, he sends out the 70, he pairs them up and he sends them out to these villages and he tells them, if you get to a place and they're resistant, I'm not just resistant, I don't want to use that word, they're beyond resistant, okay? They're stubborn, they're just not going to accept what you say and, you know, they won't let you stay in their house and they're not going to listen to what you say. He says, shake the dust off your feet, which was in their culture, a very visual way of saying, you guys aren't worth it, okay? Without saying words, you could really put them down, okay? And so he says, shake your the dust off your feet and leave. Go to the next village where they do want to hear. So there are times when we do have to be discerning whether or not we're wasting our time. And I'm going to get to that a little bit later we're going to look at a verse out of Titus that is apropos there. But there are times when we shouldn't say what we believe because it becomes a waste of time. It becomes an exercise in futility. Now, don't jump on that and go, okay, well, I don't have to tell anybody about the gospel. No, that's not what he's saying. He's not saying back off every time you get the least little bit of resistance, but there are those times when we need to get God's guidance and the Holy Spirit to let us know if we should stay there, if we should go on someplace where the gospel will be met with more welcome. And another reason, I won't say it's a final reason because I'm sure I missed some, but another reason why we should not necessarily say everything we believe is because you might be wrong. Just because you believe it doesn't mean you're right. So if you're not going to be absolutely sure you're right, then you should probably not spread it to other people. Now that is what he starts out with in James chapter 3, warning people who wanted to become teachers because teachers were highly regarded. Teachers got all kinds of respect. Teachers were revered by everybody. And so people, hey, I want to be a teacher. And he said, no, you don't understand. Because along with that comes a greater responsibility than the normal person has. So you need to think this through. Do you really want that extra responsibility? God's going to hold you accountable. So if I'm saying things because I believe them, but they turn out to be wrong, I'm held responsible for that. So I have to be careful. I stand up here and talk to you guys and say, here's the way it is. Now, within this church, there are a lot of what I call peripheral issues that a lot of us are going to disagree on. You know, we start talking about the end times, for instance, and there's many different opinions about when Jesus is coming back. We agree that he is coming back, but when exactly? Well, there's some disagreement on that. Now, I don't mind teaching you what I believe, but I happen to know that the people who disagree with me on that have some pretty good points. And so when I teach you what I think is going to happen in that situation, what I think the Bible says, I'm going to let you know this isn't the only view. There are other people who have some pretty good points. Because I don't want to be caught standing before the Lord saying, and he's saying, hey, why were you teaching that as though that was the gospel? That was the final word. When it wasn't even true. So I have to be careful. So there are times when I'll say, well, this is what I think. Okay? But there's a difference between what I think, what I believe, and what I know to be true. So I don't have to say everything that I believe to be true. There are times when that would not be right. And husbands, if you've ever had the question, do these pants make my butt look big? You know. You don't have to answer absolutely what you're thinking and what you're believing, okay? There are times, and we do this in everyday life, and we need to apply it to Scripture as well, okay? There are times when just because it's true and just because you believe it doesn't mean that you need to put it out there. And, of course, the way you put it out there makes all the difference in the world, doesn't it? So James is saying, we're going to overview here chapter 3. In an overview of chapter 3, teachers need to be careful, okay? They need to understand that there's a greater responsibility for them than there is for everybody else. In his day, teaching was primarily verbal. And what's the easiest way to get in trouble is just open your mouth, right? Just open your mouth and you're bound to get in trouble a big percentage of the time. What is the proverb? I think I put it up on one of the other slides there. That there's a proverb, and I can't remember what chapter and verse it was, but it says, it's better to be silent. Oh, there it is. Even a fool is thought wise if he keeps silent, and discerning if he holds his tongue. Okay, it's better to be thought a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. All right? So sometimes just being quiet, but teachers can't be quiet. In his day, verbal communication was the big way of teaching others about things. And so he starts out by saying, teachers need to be careful. It's a big chance for saying something wrong. And words, by the way, can never be retrieved. You know that, right? You've had that experience where the moment, I mean the split second that you said something, you wanted to grab that word and shove it back in your mouth, right? And you can't do it. You can't do it. There's no way. Once that word leaves your mouth, it's going to get to that other person. And once they hear it, you can't take it back. Now, you can use other words to mitigate what you've just said. You can apologize. You can explain what you really meant. You know, you can say, oh, that's not really what I meant to say. But those original words are still there. They've heard them, and you can't take them back. So, teachers, he says, you need to be careful. And those of you who want to become teachers, think about it carefully, because there's a greater responsibility. So, he starts out with that. And then, in order to explain himself, because we teachers like to use examples, because we think that people will be more interested and they'll listen more carefully if we use examples to try to help you. And part of that is to try to tie something that you already know into a new concept so that you can understand that new concept. So we try to find something that you're familiar with and apply it to the new thing that we're trying to teach so that you'll understand. Okay, and James is no dummy. He knows that. So he chooses, well, at least six, but the sixth one you might consider two different things, but at least six examples that he's going to give right in a row. He's going to pick up on six things to try to help them understand, try to help us understand what he means when he says the tongue is a mighty part of your body. It's a part of your body that needs the most control. He talks about horses' bits. Now, I'm no equine expert. I did a little reading this week on bits, and you know, found out that there's a little gum place so that the bit's not actually sitting on the horse's teeth, and the bit actually should be fitted to the horse's mouth because every horse is a little different, and that the bit should be used with other things like your knees, you know, to send signals to the horse. But basically what he's saying, you know, this is just a basic example. It's true that horses' bits are very, very small compared to the size of the horse. And horse is what, 800, 900, 1,500 pounds, someplace in there, depending on the horse. And this little tiny thing that you put in his mouth, you can steer that horse any place you want him to go. Okay? Generally true. I know there's all these exceptions and everything. Ship's rudders. Generally speaking, a ship's rudder is very small compared to the size of the ship. Now, I know the bigger the ship, the bigger the rudder, but still, comparing that to the size of the ship, it's still a very small thing. Well, we were in Stockholm this summer. We got to go to a museum where there was a ship called the Vasa. And this Vasa was a ship built between 1623 and 1625. It took them 2 years to build it. It's estimated that they used 40 acres of timber to build this ship. It was supposed to be this, I think they said that the oak sides of the ship were about 18 inches thick. It was supposed to be the warship to end all warships, you know. They were in the middle of a 30 years war. And the King Gustav, or whatever his name was, wanted to get this big ship and go out and beat these guys in this 30 years war. So he commissioned this thing. Took him 2 years to build it. Beautiful decorations, all kinds of stuff. The back end of the ship was about 30, 40 feet high, something like that. The rudder had to be, the rudder was about to, obviously had to start up there where in the back of the ship where they have the big wheel. And so the rudder was, extended way down 30 or 40 feet before it gets down there. And then the size of the rudder, it wasn't a little tiny thing. It was about as big as, about as tall as me. And so it was a pretty big rudder, but compared to the rest of the ship, this rudder was tiny. And it's that comparison that James is trying to make here. You know, every ship has a rudder. Now, unfortunately, see, James didn't know about the Vasa. It hadn't happened yet. And so when he writes that, ships have these rudders and, it can steer the ship wherever it wants to go, even if the wind doesn't cooperate well. They took this Vasa out on its maiden voyage, okay? They take it off the dry dock thing and out into the water, and they put the sails up, and they go out into the bay. It gets out 100 yards. A gust of wind comes from the side. It goes over sideways, and it's gone. And it wasn't until about 1950 or so that they were able to pick this thing up out of the water and take it on shore, and that's what we were seeing was this restored ship. That rudder really didn't help the ship much. But generally speaking, it's what he says is true, right? You got this little bitty rudder compared to the size of the ship, and it steers it wherever you want it to go. How about a forest fire, he says? 90% of forest fires are caused by human beings, right? You got campfires left unattended. You got wood piles that are being burned. Up in Oregon, they got a fire up there now that some kids started with some fireworks. A big one that used to be a real big one, I haven't heard about one of these causing a fire for quite a while, was cigarettes. People would chuck their cigarettes out the window. That's not even a flame. It's just a little glowing ember. It's not even a real flame, and yet it has started many, many huge fires. So he's saying, look what the little tiny spark can do. It's powerful. Wild creatures have been tamed. Now, I was interested in this translation that says, people can tame all kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and fish. I don't know. I haven't seen any guppies really doing tricks or anything, but, got your trout jumping through hoops. Maybe, it could be in those days they considered dolphins, fish and that kind of thing. And maybe they were, I don't know, maybe they were training them. But his point still is that you can take just about any animal, and if you get them from birth and bring them up around you, you can pretty much tame them. Now, that's not the same as domesticate them. There's a big difference between taming an animal and domesticating an animal. You can tame an animal, but they're still a wild animal. Ask the woman who had the chimpanzee some years ago. He was tame until he ripped her face off. And then he wasn't so tame anymore. Or a sad story coming out of South Africa this year. A little boy raised up this lion from the time he was just a little pup, or whatever they call a lion. Kitten? Anyway, The lion killed him. The lion grew up and killed him, even though he was supposedly tame. You know, follow him around all over the place. So tame animals can be tamed. You can tame them. You can get them to do all these different things, but they're still wild animals. But his point is, you can get these big beasts. You know, you can take an elephant and make an elephant do what you want him to do. Then he goes into this freshwater, saltwater thing. That's an interesting one because, and again, I'm no chemist. I pretty much flunked science when I was in school. But you mix salt with water. You don't have salt floating around in water. There's this solution that's made, right? So they kind of become a third thing. It's not just water and salt. It's salt water. And you can't really separate the things. And so you can't mix the two, he says. You can't have a person praising God and then cursing the things that God has made. It doesn't make any sense. You can't get fruit from a tree that it wasn't meant to come from. Now, again, I know you can graft in. You know, we used to have a pear tree that had three different kinds of pears on it. But you know there were no apples on that pear tree. There were no pomegranates on the pear tree. So, yeah, you have to have a certain kind of fruit on the tree. You're not going to get another kind of fruit on that tree. And then he goes back to, this is the one that could be, rolled back into the other example. He talks about the spring of water coming out of the ground. You can't get both bitter water and fresh water out of the same spring. Either it's a fresh water spring or it's a bitter water spring. You can't have, oh, I think I'll go over here a foot and get fresh water and over here I'll get bitter. It doesn't work that way. So he's got seven examples here of what he's trying to say about the need to control our tongues. If we can't understand what he's trying to say in there, we're not trying very hard. Okay? Seven different examples. So here's his points of progression. He starts out with teachers need to be careful and be aware of their responsibility because Jesus said we're responsible for every word that comes out of our mouth, right? And this is the passage I wanted you to look at. Titus. Paul writes to Titus and he says in chapter 3, verse 9, avoid foolish controversies and genealogies and arguments and quarrels about the law because they are unprofitable and useless. Warn a diversive person once, then warn them a second time. After that, have nothing to do with them. He invented the three strikes rule. You may be sure that such people are warped and sinful. They are self-condemned. Avoid certain kinds of teaching, he says. So teachers need to be aware that you can go astray as a teacher. You can end up being one of those teachers that's teaching stuff that shouldn't be taught. You start going into this area of foolish controversies, genealogies, arguments, endless discussions. And he tells Timothy in 2 Timothy 4:3, something that we've seen happen in our day, and I'm sure it's been happening all along. He says, for the time will come when people will not put up with sound doctrine or sound teaching. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. To say what their itching ears want to hear. Now, what sense is there in only listening to teachers who say what you want them to say? If we pick and choose teachers based on only those teachers who won't say anything to make me think about my own life, they won't say anything that offends me. They won't say anything that makes me want to improve myself. They won't say anything to make me understand how I can be closer to God because I'm not as close as I could be. I want to avoid anybody, any teacher who will convict me of any wrongdoing because I don't like to hear that kind of stuff. And so all I go, and you say, well, there couldn't be too many people like that. Huge churches full of people who are there simply because they know they will never be challenged. Yeah, and Paul predicted that. Come a time when people aren't going to put up with sound teaching because it rubs them the wrong way. It makes them feel guilty about stuff. Well, so teachers, he says, have to beware of the responsibility. And he says, they, those teachers, like all of us, like everybody else, are not perfect in what they say. I challenge anybody here to think that you've never said anything that you regretted. So therefore, what we say is the most difficult body function to control. And if we can control that, he says, we can control everything. The tongue, very small part compared to the whole body, very powerful. The tongue, most evil part of the body, it gets us into the most trouble. We use our tongue, he says, to pronounce righteousness and evil. He says, how can that be? Like that spring of water. How can you have both coming out of the same thing? So here's the application. Here's what I believe he wants us to learn from this. Teachers have a greater responsibility, but none of us are off the hook. So don't read chapter 3 and just look at verse 1 and go, oh, this is about people who want to be teachers. I have no desire to be a teacher, therefore I don't have to read this chapter. None of this applies to me. No, he leaves that in chapter 2. In verse 2, when he says, we all stumble in many ways. And then he goes on to explain how we all stumble. So this is applicable to all of us. Also, tongues don't speak to people. People speak to people. I know, this sounds like guns don't shoot people, people shoot people. That's where I thought of it, okay? But the tongue is just a tool. The tongue is just an instrument. It's not really the tongue's fault. James isn't saying, cut out your tongue and you're going to be perfect. Because we would find some other way to communicate, wouldn't we? We would find some other way to do ourselves in with communication. No, he's saying the physical tongue is not at fault. It happens to be the instrument that gets us into trouble. But it's controlled ultimately by our minds. So communication is the real issue, right? That's what he's really talking about. He's not talking about just this little thing we call a tongue. He's talking about communication. Communication, of course, is not limited to the spoken word. We communicate in all sorts of ways. Body language, right? You ever seen a little kid do this? Right? Body language. Who teaches them that? Body language. They pick up on that immediately. They don't have to say, I am being defiant. I am not going to do what you tell me to do. I don't like you. And I'm not going to cooperate. All they have to do is stand like this, right? Body language. And we send it off all the time. We're sending body language signals constantly. And unfortunately, a lot of the times that body language is actually communicating what we're really thinking. And remember I said we don't have to say everything we believe, but very often we do just by our body language, whether we want to or not. And then, of course, there's the written word. James, of course, was speaking about the oral communication, but there's the written word as well. Lots of books, reams and reams and reams of books have been written communicating. And you know what? You can run into the same difficulty. The thing is, if you're writing a book, you and your editors and everybody can go over and look at it before it ever gets out there. You can make things all nice and make sure it's perfect, unlike when you just open your mouth and talk. But we have something today called texting, which is almost as fast as the tongue. You notice that? You ever see anybody? I can't do this thumb thing. You know, you ever see people with you guys in the front rows, you know what I'm talking about. You got those thumbs. Those thumbs are working as fast as my tongue could say a word. You're sending a word. Same thing. It's communication. Same thing applies. Okay? Texting. Texting is as bad as speaking, and it can be as irresponsible, because you hit that send button. It's just like when you say a word and you can't take it back. You hit that send button. It's out there. Somebody's going to read it. You can't get it back. And my understanding is that You know, you send an email to somebody, even if you delete it and they delete it, it's still out there someplace, right? Now, I've asked Matt about this before. Where does it go? He's explained it to me. I don't know if he really knows or if he, you know, he's just giving me a bunch of gibberish. I wouldn't know the difference. So I don't get it. I don't know where this thing's going, you know, the internet, like it's a real thing. I don't know where it is. Nobody can point to it and say, oh, yeah, your email's right there, you know. But I know that it's out there and you can't take it back, just like that spoken word. I want to talk about Facebook for a minute. Yeah, I'm going to skip Twitter because I don't want to get political. But I think Twitter, you know that Twitter is just as bad as the spoken word, right? I mean, we've seen that. But let's talk about Facebook for a minute. I know a lot of people on Facebook. I'm on Facebook. And I decided about a year ago that I was going to make a really good effort at avoiding what Paul tells Timothy to avoid: foolish controversies, genealogies, arguments, and quarrels, because they are unprofitable and useless. Because I used to get involved in these, and then it dawned on me what Facebook is. Facebook is a way for me to tell people who think the same thing I think what I'm thinking about. They don't need their minds changed about anything because they're already thinking along. Now, I do have a few friends on Facebook who disagree with me on almost everything. And so I know that, and I know that if I try to say something to them, I know what they're going to say back. So I'm not going to change their minds, right? Has anybody? I would love to find one person who has ever changed anybody's mind by what they said on Facebook. Anybody? So what do they end up as? Foolish controversies, endless genealogies, arguments, and quarrels, right? They don't solve anything. So I decided about a year ago that I was going to stay out of that stuff because I had gotten into some big stuff. And I thought, this is ridiculous. You know, all you do is you just kind of stir up everybody and everybody's... there's all the misunderstandings because, let's face it, oral communication has its advantages. When you're communicating with somebody face-to-face, that body language can help, can it? That tone of voice can really help. Did you know that there's no way yet? Somebody's got to come up with this. I've been suggesting it for a long time. Somebody's got to come up with a way so that if I'm going to be sarcastic on Facebook, that it shows that I'm being sarcastic. You know, because there's no way to that tone of voice and so forth, you can't communicate that. And so it's just these written words and they get to interpret them any way they want. And so they're going to take all their prejudices that they have about me and they're going to read in to what I said, and they're going to come up with their own conclusion about what I meant. And it's probably nothing like what I meant. So I decided a long time ago, I'm staying out of that. Then about 2 weeks ago, I got suckered in. This long thing. And, you know, once I got in, it was like, how do I get out? Yeah. what I finally did was I said, okay, this is it. This is my last thing. I'm not saying anything more. So they can say anything you want. And I regretted being it. And then this week, another one started. And I wasn't going to get into it. I knew it was going to be one of those long ones, and I thought, no, I'm not going to get to it. But there was one thing that I wanted to say. I just wanted to agree with this guy about one thing. Well, from then on, it was not just him that was saying this. It was him and Tom. And so I was in the rest of the post. I made one little comment. And I was in the rest of this post, and I thought, I can jump in here and explain. Nope, I couldn't do it. Stayed out of it. But I shouldn't have gotten in it in the first place, right? Because Paul says, avoid foolish controversies. And a foolish controversy to me is just about anything on Facebook. Because it's not going to change anybody's mind. It's not going to promote anything. It's not going to accomplish anything good. So therefore, I should stay out of it. Well, I think that if James was alive today, if he'd been writing this letter today, I believe he would have done it differently. I don't believe he would have concentrated on the tongue. Because James is not talking about the tongue. He's really talking about communication. So I believe if he was going to write this letter today, he would write it differently. He would write it differently. And I believe what he would concentrate on would be our digits. Now, how many of you learned to type in a real class? All right, so you know that it's the pinky finger that hits that enter, right? You get done typing what you want to type, that pinky finger hits enter, right? And then the email goes or the text goes or whatever, right? Now, those of you who are younger than me, a lot of you, your thumb is it, right? Your thumb is the digit of choice, and when you hit enter, it's that. Or maybe it's your, what is that, the pointer finger? Hits the mouse button, right? So, clicks that mouse button. So you can, I'm gonna assume James is talking to my generation, and I'm gonna use pinky finger. But you can substitute whatever digit you happen to use in here. And here's what I think an alternate translation of James chapter 3 verses 2:10 would sound like. If anyone is never at fault of what he posts, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses and make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the pinky finger is a small part of the body, but it finalizes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The pinky is also a fire, a world of evil among the parts of body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man, but no man can tame the pinky finger. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With the pinky, we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same keyboard come praise and cursing. I don't think I'm too far off there. You notice I said think. But I don't think I'm too far off there. I think if James was writing today, he would address the parts of communication that were the most appropriate for us. And with us, it's not oral language anymore. We avoid oral language, right? You don't call somebody, you text them because you don't want to talk to them or you don't want them talking back to you. So you text them. So I believe James would change things if he were writing this today. So, control of our tongues is necessary to be consistent with our status as God's children. He's just adding another part to the letter. Over in chapter 1 and chapter 2, he's talking about doing what you say. He's talking about not showing favoritism. Those things are things that he says you have to be aware of, you have to do in order to be consistent with what you say you believe. And in chapter 3, he's saying, now, communication. When you communicate with others, you have to do so in such a way that it reflects the person that you are, the saved person that you are, the redeemed person that you are, the child of God that you are. What you say needs to be consistent with your status as God's children. So here's the big picture for the whole letter. The context of the whole letter is that our actions must exhibit what we claim to believe, whether it's what we do, favoritism that we show or don't show, or what we say. All of those things need to exhibit what we claim to believe. And so, I call this talk the walk. Yeah, we got to walk the talk, but we also have to talk the walk. It all has to come in line. We all have to, all those little compartments of our lives have to fit together. They have to flow together so that we have one picture of a redeemed human being who is a child of God. Father, we want to thank you for loving us. You are so merciful to us. You are so forgiving. Help us, Father, this week as we go our separate ways, as we think about how we communicate with others, as we think about what we say, what we do, what we write, that we will be consistent in praising you and in lifting up your love for others to see, for others to hear. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.